WTLC AM, W224 DI, W236 CR, Indianapolis. It's time to discuss the important topics happening in and around Indy. It's Community Connection with Tina Cosby, brought to you by Child Advocates. Your voice, their future, on AM 1310, 92.7, 95.1 FM, The Light.
And good afternoon. Welcome to Community Connection. I'm Tina Cosby. Today is Wednesday, June 22nd. Lots to get to on our show today, including a closer look at those military honor flights. If you've never heard of them, you're going to learn more, but we're going to take a closer look at those as well. We're going to speak with a veteran advocate dedicated to making sure that they continue and why he feels so strongly about it. We'll also talk about a local production coming up that examines a painful dynamic in our African-American culture. But first, let's bring in our contributing analyst, James Patterson. James, welcome back.
Hey, Tina. Thank you. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. You're doing good.
You got your radio voice on. I'm doing good, right?
Yeah. So, well, it's kind of like my allergies voice. It just, I have not struggled as long as I have for years. I mean, I normally just a little sneeze here and there and boom, it's gone. But man, and you know, the other day I went to get some allergy relief stuff and it looked like somebody had made a raid. The shelves were almost empty. So I don't feel so badly that it's just me. That you know, you can hardly find anything because everybody's buying the stuff up real quickly. So
yeah, and unfortunately, this kind of time of year with the humidity is lingering as it does with these 90 degree temperatures.
Yeah,
it really causes a lot of problems like that. Yeah. So, and I wish you the best in trying to find something.
Oh, it's okay. But anyhow. What's going on, James? There's a lot. We like I was saying, we've got a couple of really good interviews coming up. The first, it's a play called Star Midnight, but what's behind the play, I think, is so much more important than just talking about an event, and we're going to discuss that. It's a dynamic, it's a divide, and that's all I'm going to tell you until we get there. Also on, at the end of the, at 2:30, end of the second hour, we're going to have a conversation about something that you questioned. You said, I'm not quite sure about, the honor flights.
Yeah, for veterans, I guess they resumed those after COVID. It's something we'll talk about, but it's something that they use to try to do something for veterans. And in this particular initiative, actually, it's focused on improving the lives of veterans, has been going on for a long time, but it still, I don't believe, has gotten to where it should be. If a person puts his or her life on the line for this country, they should be, I think, the first in line for education, for jobs, for housing, for everything. But, that's just my take, and we'll talk about that because that's kind of the theme of what they want to talk about. And, we didn't mention the weather, so we encourage everyone to be cautious. It's really hot out there, although the humidity isn't what it was at the peak of the heat. Last week, it's heading that way until we get a little bit of relief in the next day or two. But then it's back up, back up again with the heat. But we'll be in the low 90s today. Some areas in the metropolitan area will reach the mid-90s. But the thing is that If you don't have air conditioning or if you know people who live alone, my advice is to check on them because you can get into serious trouble if you're exposed to this heat for a long time. And there are some thunder showers that are possible, particularly in the South Metropolitan area, south of I-70, basically, later on this afternoon. But most of the population of the city will not see a shower, I don't believe. And so we'll just be hot, low to mid 90s, take care of yourself and your neighbor.
Yeah. Well, thank you for that. Yeah. And it is, it is that time. Yesterday, the first day of summer. James, a couple of things. We've been in summer for a while, that heat wave before, that spring, 100 degrees in the spring. I don't know. Indiana, global warming. Yeah, indeed. So, James, a couple of things before our first guest arrives. Yesterday, I don't know if you were familiar with it or if you listened to it or what have you, but I tell you what, yesterday's hearing, the last part of it, I did get to see the select January 6th committee hearings that they've been having, that we've been encouraging, as many people to listen to as possible. I tell you what, of all of them, that one got me. I was absolutely enthralled, and I was furious, I was angry, I was, sympathetic to the poor woman, the women who had to go through that. I mean, it's pure thuggery. Thuggery. Yeah. And then beyond that, to quote one of our callers, it has to be, it cannot be described as anything else but fascism, right? I mean, that's the very the definition, is it not?
Yeah, it is. It is. It's really, I was thinking about the Third Reich and Hitler, and these are kind of the things that they did. I mean, these poor women that you alluded to, Wanda Shea Moss, a Georgia election,
I think, in Fulton County,
and her mother, Ruby Freeman, were terrorized.
Yes.
And it was simply made up.
They just...
they were accused...
No, I'm going. Go ahead. I'm going. They pulled it out of the air. They just decided that's what they wanted to do. And they just chose these black women.
Just contrived. Out of the thin air, they were accused of removing and scanning ballots from a suitcase. Never happened. Never happened. Never even thought about. There was no proof, iota proof. But these women were terrorized. And I'll use that, willingly, that because they felt... I mean, hey, this is the South with its history of lynchings and all of the madness, the craziness, subjugation against black people. And here we are trying to participate in the American process, and we get accused of these crimes. It reminds me of, the senator from Wisconsin who was crazy back in the day, and they had those, they were calling everybody communists and things. And I saw one clip where I can't remember this lady. I think her name was, I won't even call her name, but she was accused, a black lady up there in front of Congress, and all of these powerful white men accusing her of being a communist. Can you imagine? But this is what Wanda Shea Moss and her mother, Ruby Freeman, went through, that was televised yesterday in those January 6th hearings. And Tina, they felt, it not only broke their spirit, but they were put under a, what's a better word for it? I mean, they just felt so broken, and they described it. Who would ever want to go through something like that? Who, Tina? Who in the world?
And to think that the president of the United States of America decided to pick on poor little O'Shea Moss and her mom and her grandmother and rough them up just so that he could make a point that he, or tried to figure out how to get them to prove his point that he won the election, by any means necessary, at any cost. I mean, they were accused of passing each other jump drives or drives. It was a ginger mint. They were accused of putting documents underneath the table. It was just horrible. The grandmother, they burst into the grandmother's house. They ordered large amounts of pizza. I mean, just total harassment. Total harassment.
This is based on lies. Lies.
Lies, lies, lies. Lies.
How can we, liars will never stand. A lie will never endure.
Yeah.
We just, you just cannot. Darkness cannot overcome light. So the whole thing, the whole Trump big lie is based upon lies.
Yeah.
And those who, you know, even though they love him, they love what he stands for, they love his policies, it's based upon lies.
Yeah.
And you cannot let that continue.
Well, those who are upholding it, I have an even deeper, even darker look at those who continue to uphold him, to uphold the Giulianis, to uphold, you know, all of the others. It just, you know... Well, I guess that my biggest emotion yesterday was how in the world are these two people, just those two, just Trump and Giuliani, still walking around free as a bird? How in the world are they able to do that?
Well, there's criminal liability here. I'm not either. I'm not the Justice Department.
Mm-mm.
You aren't either. We're not lawyers.
Mm-mm.
But there's criminal liability here because of the testimony we had yesterday. Not even to mention Senator Johnson, speaking of Wisconsin, who entertained and claimed he didn't know anything about it. His staff, and I believe he was, you know, his chief of staff was talking. So the chief of staff doesn't tell the senator what's going on. But anyway, his staff was entertaining a scheme to defraud the American people by replacing a list of Biden electors with a list of illegitimate electors who supported Donald Trump. That's a scheme that he could be liable for. But nonetheless, like you said, Giuliani and John Eastman, the top two lieutenants for Trump, they are in a serious world of trouble. Trust me. They're in trouble because it's not that anything got done. And even the electors, the people who signed on, who signed documents to be electors, they are liable. I'm telling you, this is when you attempt to overthrow a government, even on paper, you are liable.
Well, it would appear, James, but I'm telling you right now, it doesn't seem like... It just doesn't seem like there's
any... It doesn't seem like anything's going to get done about it.
No, it doesn't seem like there's any interest, any... it just doesn't seem like there's any urgency or what have you. This is clear and present, and a clear and present danger to people everywhere. I mean, you mean to tell me that these tactics, that just because somebody says it, that they can go bursting into the houses of people and threatening to arrest them and harass them in order? Where's the protection? But anyway, so that, you know, my like I said, my biggest emotion yesterday was, why are these people not arrested? And I, you know, Merrick Garland and the Justice Department, DOJ, and, you know, some of these states are moving more aggressively.
If you say that I am I'm the legitimate president, if you say I am the legitimate governor of Indiana, knowing that you are not. Okay, that's fine. But if you sign documents, if you put together a scheme to sign documents and usurp the power, I believe that's liability. I mean, I'm not a lawyer, but to me.
Well, it is, James. Here's the thing, though, and it gets to my frustration, which is, why is there nothing being done about it? You can't tell me that Garland doesn't have that information. If the committee has it, Garland. But anyway, that's my thing. I just feel... I just feel almost helpless because you're sitting here watching it just erode, and then you have people that seemingly are sitting back not wanting to do anything because they don't want to erode democracy. Well, guess what? Not acting is eroding it. So,
not to forget Donald Trump either, because he orchestrated the whole thing. And I don't care if you are a former president, no one should be. They say no one is, but no one should be above the law.
Yeah, indeed. We had a caller just a few minutes ago, as our friend Nyla, that wanted to make sure that we knew about. I believe we've talked about this before, and I think I'm sure we did. But, you know, we can mention it again. But, you know, IPS is hosting a series of meetings, James. Rebuilding Stronger.
I heard that.
Yeah, phase two is tomorrow at 5 to 6 at William Penn School, 4917 West Wilkins Street. And, again, I believe we did have someone in previewing that. And tomorrow is the next one. So, Nyla, thank you for the reminder.
Next one. I wish she could have stayed on. She didn't want to stay on and come.
Well, no. No, I don't know. She probably had something to do, but just wanted to remind her. So, rebuilding. The other thing, James, that I talked to with David about this yesterday. I'm not going to go too much into it, but the description of the police behavior in Uvalde, being called by a top, a top law enforcement officer who was just absolutely furious as he was testifying. He called the operation an abject failure and basically said that within 3 minutes there was enough manpower, firepower, and protection for those officers to have taken down that shooter, and there's a strong reason to believe the doors weren't even unlocked. The doors weren't even locked. So just another tragedy that, and they, you know, when you think within 3 minutes they could have taken it down, how many of those kids' lives could have been saved because it was well over an hour before they even started to engage the gunman.
They were standing there with long guns, team.
Long guns and shields and ballistic shields. Yeah, standing there with long guns and ballistic
shields. You know, gun grenades, everything they needed to go in there.
Yeah, so. And it makes you wonder if there might be some criminal liability there, too, because to me, that's that could be criminal.
We got to get through the investigation, but I agree with you. Merrick Garland, you know, we all cheered for him when he was denied that seat on the Supreme Court. But you're not a Supreme Court justice. You're the lead prosecutor in the United States. And so you need to be moving forward on both that January 6th and anything else that's happening around the country that needs to be, you know, where justice needs to be done.
It does indeed. And boy, oh boy. Each day it gets worse, doesn't it, James? Each day you've got little kids inside begging for help, calling 911. And, there's folks standing outside, law enforcement standing outside with, and as the chief said, those kids had nothing. The officers had guns. The kids had, they had crayons maybe, but they had nothing.
They couldn't defend themselves.
No. Yeah, they were also talking this morning, which I found interesting, about perhaps as a result of this, changing the training and the protocol, instead of telling kids to huddle together, maybe have kids fight back or run away, run for your lives. I don't know, but somebody brought that up this morning, early this morning on one of the talk shows. I thought that was interesting that perhaps it bears another look, because if they're bunched together and the shooter is right there, look at all the targets he has right there together. So, there's some thought given to that as well. Yesterday, James, you weren't here. But we've been hearing about this for quite a while, about COVID-19 vaccines that are going to be available for children ages 6 months to 5 years. Yesterday was the first day, I do believe, that those vaccines became available. And I tell you, it doesn't sound like it's going to be as good or as easy a sell, James, as it has been for the adults or even children ages 12 to 18. There's just a lot more hesitancy.
Resistance.
There's a lot more resistance because a lot of parents are just not sold on, having their children 6 months to 5 years. There's some that are. There's some that can't wait.
It's new technology, Tina. Many people are going to be skeptical of new technology. You and I had no problem taking it. And we know by the record that it saved millions of lives. We have over 1 million people who sadly died, but it saved millions of lives.
Yeah.
But when it comes to their children, people are very skeptical.
That young. And I understand. I get it.
Yeah.
But it may take a little bit longer for that one to sink through, as if it wasn't hard enough in the African American community getting us to accept vaccines in the first place. But one of the things that might help, and here's a release that we got, Saturday, June 25th at noon, the Indianapolis Alumni Chapter of Delta Sigma Theta Sorority, the Indianapolis Alumni Chapter of Kappa Alpha Psi, and Iota Phi Theta Fraternity, Inc., Alpha Omega Chapter, will join the National Council of Negro Women and the Good Health Initiative to provide an opportunity for community engagement. So what this is going to be, James, is... it's called Giving the Facts and Dispelling the Myths, a community conversation about COVID-19 and vaccination updates. And again, it's going to be this Saturday, June 25th at noon. It's going to be at the Center for Black Literature and Culture, which is at the Indianapolis Public Library, the Central Library. So the Central Library has this center, and that's at 40 East St. Clair. So all of these community partners are getting together, in addition to the sororities and fraternities, to put together this conversation. There'll be physicians there, of course, and of course, vaccinations are going to be offered. Public event, free, welcome. Everybody's welcome, open to the public, and but just an opportunity to get out there and have that conversation, especially in light of the news recently that just dropped, so to speak, about now vaccinations are available for the youngest and most vulnerable of our population. So I don't know, James. That's going to be an interesting conversation.
Yeah, and it's going to have some really good panelists who can answer questions. Mm-hmm. I think it's going to, Dr. Virginia Kane, Director of the Marion County Public Health Department. It will be one panelist, Dr. Eric Yancey, a local pediatric specialist, and Dr. Levi Funches, a neonatologist.
Yeah, he's been a guest on our show a couple of times.
Yeah,
Levi Funches. So yes, he has. That
Dr. Kane, Dr. Funches, and Dr. Yancey will be the panelists. So that I think the panel discussion's at noon, and then they'll have vaccinations at 1 p.m. But giving the facts and dispelling the myths, a community conversation about COVID-19 and vaccine updates. Uh-huh. Saturday.
And how many times have we had Dr. Kane on talking about COVID?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Dr. Yancey as well. And Dr. Yancey has even been a guest host of the show. And he, too, during his guest hosting, talked about a number of things, including COVID. It's interesting because we've asked a lot of things of Dr. Yancey. And he was even saying, well, we need to wait. We need to find out more. You know, when asking him about children ages 6 months to 5 years of age.
He's skeptical? Or?
No, he wasn't skeptical. No, please don't put that. No, he was saying, we want to find out more. I want to see what the research says. But if anything, he was saying they're not there yet.
Oh.
You see what I'm saying?
Cautious, would you say cautious would be a word we could
use? I think he was cautiously optimistic, but at the time when he was asked, which was last year, he said, it's coming, but they're not there. Those were his words. He said, it's coming, but they're not there yet. He said, so we'll just wait and see. But no, there was no skepticism on his part. So please don't. No, yeah, I don't want that to come out. But he did say, and I appreciated that, because his point was, they're not there yet. You know, we're not there yet. So, you know, let's wait and see what happens and see what they come out with. So my guess is if he, Dr. Kane, and Dr. Funches are all going to be on this panel, then they're good. They're good with it. I think they're good. They wouldn't, if they were not, they would not be on that panel.
And this is 6 months to
5 years.
Over, really?
6 months. Yeah, six months to five. Yeah.
6 months to five.
I would like for them to explain it, though. I mean, is it the same medication? Is it a different dosage? There's a lot of questions. Yeah. We may need to get them on here, just on here in general. I encourage people with questions to go to the community conversation, because that's going to be a good opportunity. But, we can also get them here as well to talk about that. So, yeah.
Yeah. When it comes to your children, people are just a little bit, and that's the reason why you said it hasn't really, taken off. And then plus the fact that they're, the veracity of the disease has not is not the same as it was when COVID first hit. It's not. I mean, this brand of sub brand of the Omicron variant that we're seeing is not as virulent. It's not as it's milder than what we've seen before. So that too might bring some hesitancy for the parents. I can use that term, hesitancy for the parents to pick it up. So,
but they, you know what? They wouldn't be good parents if they didn't want to know everything about it, want to read about it, know about it. Because again, we're talking about the wee little ones, you know, we're talking about the wee little ones. So you got to be careful.
Yeah.
Got to be careful. And James, I'm not going to get too excited about this one because just the minute you say something and you know, so many steps forward, so many steps back, and so forth. But it looks like the progress is being made on that Senate gun bill. I know. We're not going to say too much about it. So.
But they did move it. They did move it along in the Senate. They had 14 Republicans join them in moving the bill, so it will come to the floor. They are hoping to pass it this week. And let me see if I can. You know, if you want me to, I can kind of give the highlights of that. It doesn't go nearly as far as we want it to go. However, what it does do is it expands background checks for those 18-year-olds, and I think it's 18 to 21.
Yeah,
people who are under 21. It expands the background checks for them, and there's something about a law for people who are. I mean, let me see if I got it here, Tina.
Yeah.
I wrote that down.
Well, there's the boyfriend loophole, I think.
Yeah, the boyfriend loophole.
Yeah,
it prevents domestic abuse partners living outside the home from buying a gun.
Okay.
So if somebody is an abuser, they've been identified by the courts as an abuser or the police as an abuser, then they can't go and get a weapon and settle this thing their way. So that helps. But you know what? Like you said, we're not there yet. We don't know if these changes, like the red flag laws that are in it, you know, and who will be identified as a red flag and how they're going to do that. All those details need to be worked out. So we can't say until we see the details,
until we see the print.
Yeah.
We indeed. You know what, James? We're going to take a quick break right here. And when we come back, we're going to explain Star Midnight. Back in a moment.
Let's get back to the conversation. It's Community Connection with Tina Cosby from Isaacs and Isaacs Injury Lawyers, WeWin.com Studios on AM 1310, 92.
McDonald's is not new to chicken. So maybe stop questioning their chicken cred and get your hands on the McCrispy. Juicy fried chicken, buttery bun, unmatched pickle to chicken ratio. Yeah, they know what they're doing. In fact, we can honestly say they're not new to chicken. They're true to chicken. The McCrispy. Only at McDonald's. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
7, 95.1 FM, The Light.
And we're back with Community Connection. I'm Tina Cosby, joined by our contributing analyst, James Patterson. James, our first guest takes us to the not often discussed, but seriously uncomfortable, sometimes disturbing light skin, dark skin divide among African Americans. James, a Newsweek article, Newsweek, of course, being a majority culture or white publication, mostly white publication, not Jet, Ebony, Essence, Black Enterprise, or any of those, because we know that those publications get it. But in a Newsweek article, I found really interesting, not only did Newsweek see the need to examine it, but for the most part, James, they got it right. The Newsweek article from, and this is from about 12 years ago, which also surprised me, but the look at their dynamic, what they called the dynamic was the ugly roots of the light skin, dark skin divide. And it reads, I'm just going to read a little part of it because it's a long article, but It reads, since the days of slavery, skin color has been used as a tool of separation and preferential treatment within the black community. The residue of the House versus Field Negro divide has long remained with us, even as we celebrated black pride in the 70s, hip-hop culture in the 80s. House slaves were usually products of a relationship between a master and a female slave, so they tended to have lighter skin. The boss's offspring would more than likely receive the special favor of doing work inside the house out of the hot sun. They'd eat better, often get taught to read and write, and enjoyed many of the liberties of the non-slaves. Now, slaves with darker skin were usually stuck with toiling in the fields. The anger over that old distinction has never quite gone away in African-American culture. Our first guests have taken that dynamic and brought it to life. What are we talking about? They are about to explain. Here with us now are Deborah Ashanti, the founder and artistic director of the Ashanti Children's Theater and the Ashanti Art Institute of Indiana. Deborah, welcome to Community Connection. Welcome back, I should say, because I think you've been on before.
Thank you. Yes, thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
Very happy to have you. And with you is Francine May. She is an actress, community activist, I might say, as well. And in the production Star Midnight, plays one of the lead roles of Granny. Miss Mays, welcome to Community Connection. How are you?
Doing very well, Tina. And again, thank you for this opportunity.
Oh, thank you for being here. And also with us is Ashley Baskin. She is a teaching artist and the artistic program lead. Is that correct, Ms. Baskin?
Yes, ma'am. Yes. Oh. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon. And so, Tom Joyner's, I'm going to tell you all something, and I don't know if you're familiar, when he was on the radio, and I think it's still, I don't know if it's still going on, but Tom Joyner's Fantastic Voyage Cruise, which raises money for, you know, HBCUs and African-American colleges and universities, predominantly African-American colleges and universities, and one of the featured events on that cruise was the light skin versus dark skin water gun fight, and there were bragging rights and honors to go to the winner, and so there would be this big buildup, light skin versus dark skin, you know, and it was a commitment. Look over what has been such a painful dynamic in our community over the years. And I think that that comedic look at it probably has probably helped over the years in some very unusual ways. I don't know. I'm not sure about that. But here we have the production Star Midnight. So tell us, Deborah, about Star Midnight. It's inception. Tell us how it all came to be.
Well, it was inspired by one of my longtime performers, Latoria Gowdy.
Mm-hmm.
I was watching from the audience. She was in a show, and a couple little girls kept commenting on how dark she was.
Mm-hmm.
And every time she entered the stage, they were like, "Ugh, look at her, she's so dark." And I leaned over and I said, "And beautiful."
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And from that conversation, it got in my head, like, they couldn't take their eyes off of her. Whenever she was on stage, their eyes went to her, yet they didn't know how to process their how she drew them in like that.
Mm-hmm.
That it was her beauty and her melanin that made their eyes go to her.
Mm-hmm.
We've been taught that is such a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
That we, you know, we process it like, oh, I'm just drawn to this because it's so terrible. So I wanted to write something about it that would entertain, but also get us thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And how, and about self-acceptance, about loving oneself, no matter what package you come in.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we are accomplishing that with Star Midnight.
Mm. And Ms. Mays, you have one of the starring roles, one of the primary roles, because you play Granny. Tell us a little about Granny and where you found her as a character, where you found her so that you can portray her.
Well, it's very unique that Granny is light-complected, which is, you know, fits me, and I'm color-struck. You know, I fit in this category that I only am drawn to light-skinned people.
Mm-hmm.
And very offended by dark-skinned people.
Mm-hmm.
And my character really attacks an innocent little girl because of her skin color, just because that is the arena I was raised in and the arena that I lived in for so many years.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, where do you find your loyalties? Do you stick your loyalties with who you grew up with, or do you transfer your loyalties to this little girl that is your granddaughter and who you should be protecting?
Mm-hmm. So this is your granddaughter you're in charge of?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. And so Ms. Baskin, who among us on this call, and you too, James, who among us doesn't know that and has never seen it, has never experienced it?
I'm sorry, are you talking about just the colorism?
Yeah, the divide. I can't imagine an African-American, light, medium, dark. Well, I can't imagine any of us that has not experienced this dynamic.
Exactly. Whether you've been, I am darker skinned, so haven't been on the receiving end of, the ridicule and things like that. And to an extent, right, as a defense mechanism, you know, as I was younger, may have kind of bit back at those who were lighter, right?
So,
no, you're absolutely right. This is something that colorism in our community, unfortunately, is something that still plays a big, big role.
Mm-hmm.
And especially as being younger, when we're still developing and figuring out ourselves, it can, unfortunately, if you've had negative experiences with that, begin to impact how you feel about yourself, how you feel or how you determine your own worthiness.
Mm-hmm.
And so, absolutely, it's something that unfortunately is pervasive in our community. But this show is a celebration of and a reconciliation of not only, the color dynamic within our culture, but also just a celebration of when you learn yourself. And that freedom that comes with being able to not only embrace that, but like live in that truth.
Yeah. And it's interesting because I have an aunt now. She's in her late 70s, I think, or whatever. But anyway, she processed it and made it all right for her and for the next generation. My aunt, they're from a family of 10, and they're, in that family of 10 is just about every color of the rainbow. You know, there's very, very, very light, which she was extremely light, the curly hair and everything like that, to average African-American. Okay, so her thing was that she never wanted her children to go through what she went through as a child, the being bullied, being ridiculed, made fun of, and things of that nature, because she was so light-skinned. She did not want her children to go through that. And so in her mind, she had an aversion to anybody that she dated that was light-skinned.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, she was determined. She said, my children will never go through that. And that's how she settled it. And so there, as you were saying, there was an aversion and a preset notion that I will never, ever date or marry a light-skinned man. He has to bring some color to the table or else it's not going to happen. And she tells us that. And that was her guiding principle in life. And again, that's how she processed it and that's how she settled it. But again, you talk about the pain that was painful for her.
Right.
On the other side, and I'm sure, just as it's painful for, the other side. But to be able to bring this to a stage and in an entertaining way, my understanding, Deborah, is that this is not the first time this has been on stage. Is that correct? Is it backed by popular demand?
Right. It is something I wanted to revisit. Our original star was the actress that inspired it, LaToria Gowdy.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And she's going through some medical challenges right now,
mm-hmm.
and we're trying to lift her up in our prayers. So we're doing it as a tribute, and I think it's a very timely subject. It's about accepting yourself, no matter who comes at you.
Mm-hmm.
Like that being strong enough to stand your ground,
live your life,
live your dreams. I'm so blessed that Francine is playing Granny, because Granny's a really important character.
Mm-hmm.
Granny feels like she loves Star, and she tells her, "I love you," but, you know, and even shares with her because Star's an orphan, and when Star's parents died, Granny had to step up because there was nobody else. And Granny shares with her when she first saw how dark she was, if she could handle it. She came from one of those families that, you know, everybody, you know, and they know they don't marry dark. And that's why.
She, we know those families. Yeah. They don't get dark up in there.
It disowned her daughter. So it's a very nuanced part, showing that even though sometimes we feel like we are loving and protecting, we are really hurting one another, you know.
Yeah.
So, that has to be established, and Francine does a very good job of it. And in this case, Ashley is also co-director. She is artistic lead for the program department, but I invited her on to co-direct with me because her musicality, her being a dark-skinned, lovely woman, and just the perspective of another generation.
Where do you think we are now with that dynamic, the divide, the light-skinned, dark-skinned divide? Where are we? Where do you feel as if we are as a society?
That it's still here and it's still a threat, not as threatening as it once was, but it's something that I like your sharing the story about the Tom Joyner cruise, because I think that is a place we need to go where, yes, there is the many shades of black, and to accept them all.
Yeah. There's bragging rights to both. You know, there's joy in both. And I wish my aunt would have been on that cruise, because she would enjoy it. She's always rebelled against her fair skin look. So
that's because she was bullied like Star is bullied in this play. I remember being in St. Louis and wanting to join a friend group, and they said, "No, you got to be darker than a paper bag."
Yeah, the brown skin paper bag test.
Right.
Wow.
It's the opposite.
Wow.
They said, "No, you can't be in our group, friend, because you're not darker than a paper bag."
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, you know what, Deborah? Don't feel bad, because I had to tell you, you have to understand, my mother had an incredible sense of humor, but my mother was darker skinned than I am, much darker skinned than I am. My father, obviously, fair skinned, the mixture. Well, people don't know what I look like. But anyway, but I remember her telling me when I was first born, and they handed her to me, she's like, "Oh, no, that can't be my baby." Because she was thinking, but, you know, because she said, "Tina, you look like a little white rat." I said, "Oh, Mom." And she said, "You did." And I just was scared. She said, "Your grandmother took you and she held you." But she said, "I had to warm up to you," because I couldn't believe that something that light had come out of me. And I said, "Well, Mom," I said, "how you feel now?" She said, "Well, you're all right now. You're okay. You're okay." So, I mean, but it was done in such a loving way that I never felt. I mean, she loved to tell that story about how I looked like a little rat with no color. No, but I, you know, I said, "Well, Mom, I didn't know." But my grandmother, you know, she accepted right away. But yeah, and that's why I think sometimes, you know, like the Fight, which is comedy, or like, you know, Star Midnight, which is entertainment or whatever. I think sometimes if we can mix that, we can get through some of the hurtful things. We can.
Absolutely.
Because go ahead.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead. No, go ahead. Go ahead.
No, that's kind of what we do as a culture, right? It's like that whole, like, laugh that keeps from crying. And so you're exactly right. If there's a balance between, like, you know, obviously not completely minimizing or diminishing the situation or the trauma, but using art, using, you know, comedy, using those things almost as a therapeutic mm-hmm. or just a coping mm-hmm. mechanism,
yeah.
begin to explore and unpack and process those mm-hmm. things. Because
yeah.
like Mr. Sante said, I do think it's still a part of our culture, but I also think, as she also mentioned, you know, it's not as, I just know in how I grew up versus what I see now,
mm-hmm.
even from a representation standpoint, there are more, there's more variety in the spectrum of, you know, complexion that we see, you know, on television, that
mm-hmm.
we see represented in social media. And I think social media and those types of platforms have also kind of created opportunities for those that may not be, that may mm-hmm. not have had access via mainstream media.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, we're growing and mm-hmm. we're seeing and we're working, but
yeah.
still got a long way to go.
Yeah. You know what? I'm so grateful that we have a generation that it's not as sharp of a divide as it once was.
Mm-hmm.
We have a generation coming up that is like, they kind of shrug their shoulders like, huh?
Mm-hmm.
And James, I'm sorry. James Patterson, our contributing analyst is on this panel as well. And James, you've been listening to all of us women talk. I mean, by all means, feel free to jump in.
get a voice of a man, huh?
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm just saying.
Now this is, I enjoyed, listening, or am enjoying listening to Miss Asante and Miss Mays and Miss Baton, although
Miss Baskin, yeah.
Between
mm-hmm.
huh?
Miss Baskin. Mm-hmm.
Baskin.
Yeah.
I can't tell the voices between Miss Mays and Miss Baskin sometimes.
Oh, okay.
No. This is a scheme that emanated from slavery.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Darker colored people within the black race
mm-hmm.
were
mm-hmm.
not as good as lighter colored people. It was a planned, you know, it just didn't happen like that. This was mm-hmm. the makeup of the mm-hmm. whole society.
Right. Right.
And this falsity was thrust upon people as part of the racial superiority mm-hmm. hegemony.
Mm-hmm.
This hegemony or scheme or plan is not the fault of the person.
Mm-mm.
No matter what color you are, light, mm-hmm. medium, brown, white, dark chocolate,
mm-hmm.
mahogany, whatever color you are, God made us each individually, and each person is beautiful
mm-hmm.
inside
mm-hmm.
in their own right. So
mm-hmm.
this is just a scheme. And you know what? The reason why it's not getting worse, and I think you guys said it's getting, you don't see it as much, I think Mr. Sante said, is because the younger people now are seeing those images on TV where they didn't see anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Although I think my
mm-hmm.
wife commented just recently, Tina, that she wished there were more black children
mm-hmm.
on these commercials mm-hmm. on TV. But nonetheless, there are more than there were before.
Mm-hmm.
And the younger people, I just love to see people who don't care.
Yeah,
they don't
yeah.
care what color you
yeah.
are.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting when you mentioned TV, James. I remember listening to an interview with the late comedian Bernie Mac, who had a very successful television show, The Bernie Mac Show. And he said one of the very first things he lobbied for was that if they were going to have children, one of the children had to look like him, meaning of his hue, his skin color. And he said, because I'm tired of looking on these TV shows that have black families and none of the kids look like anybody, you know, they just don't look like anybody, that they don't look like they belong in the same family, or they don't look like anybody that I played with down the street or what have you. And I thought that was a wonderful stand that he took, and a wonderful victory that he got, because he was able to get the oldest
out there, and you see the colors of the rainbow.
Yeah, you see that's what he was saying. That's what he was saying.
Does it make?
Well, it made a difference to him as far as artistic expression.
Yeah.
When we do what we do on stage for families,
mm-hmm.
we are presenting a situation that will provoke conversation.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. And you yeah. walk away. And even and the beauty of theater is that it confronts you without mm-hmm. getting in your face. In the
mm-hmm.
dark, sitting in that theater, if you see yourself on stage, you understand that. And you have a conversation with yourself. Nobody's in your face saying, this is your problem. You are
mm-hmm.
sitting there quietly in a darkened theater thinking, huh, is that my problem?
Mm. Mm.
You know, so it can be very powerful. And this production has 20-something cast members ranging from 12 to Miss Fran.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so we've already generated lots of conversations within our cast. Mm-hmm. About things that they have to understand to present it on stage.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
also we talk about cyberbullying.
Mm-hmm.
There's
mm-hmm.
a girl
oh, yeah.
who mm-hmm. is obese, and she's a big girl, and she's bullied.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's
mm-hmm.
it's I'm very proud of the work, guys. Mm-hmm. I'm proud of the two ladies that are on the radio with me right now, and that's just the tip of the iceberg.
Okay, well, tell us about the work and how our listeners and our community can participate and take advantage and enjoy the production. Tell us all about it.
Wonderful. We open on Friday,
mm-hmm.
this Friday, the 24th,
mm-hmm.
At the Warren Performing Arts Center.
Beautiful facility.
Which is on the
yeah.
campus mm-hmm. of Warren High School. And that's community night. All tickets are $10, even at the door, and a lot of tickets have already been sold for that night. And we continue on Saturday at 8 o'clock, and we close on Sunday at 4. There are only 3 performances.
Mm-hmm.
It's our return to the stage, Tina, after more than 2 years of being away.
Yeah, COVID, so, COVID.
Yes,
and speaking of which, are there any COVID protocols that those that are going need to know and be aware of?
Well, no, we have not. We have not set any.
Okay.
Yeah.
There we go.
Yeah.
Just
we
just...
have not set any. If you know you wear your mask, that's fine. No, we have. You
okay.
With that one.
Okay, no problem. No problem at all. So, if people want to get, will tickets be available at the door, or does everything have to be purchased in advance? And if so, where do they need to be purchased?
Starting Friday, tickets are $12 in advance and $15 at the door.
Okay, so you can purchase it.
And Sunday,
mm-hmm.
10 o'clock, I mean, $10 on Friday, regardless, at the door or mm-hmm. in advance. Because that's community night.
Mm-hmm.
We always try to, you know, get the community in. And we're giving a lot of free tickets away to youth groups.
Mm-hmm.
But most of those are mostly gone. But you can go online. If you go to our website, AsanteArtInstitute.org, you'll get instructions and a link to go online and purchase your tickets.
Indeed. Well, thank you all so much. This sounds exciting. It's certainly going to generate a lot of conversation, and it sounds not only exciting but very entertaining. Deborah, thank you. Ms. Mays, Ms. Baskin.
I hope you and James can make it. I'd be delighted to see you there.
If I can, I've got to go out of town Friday and Saturday, but I hope if I can be back Sunday in time, I certainly will. I'd love to see it. I certainly will try to make it.
What an important message. I mean, this mm-hmm. needs to be dealt with. This
yeah.
needs to be dealt with.
Yeah, I think it's wonderful. Absolutely. All the best to you, and thank you again for coming on and sharing with us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you, indeed. And James, this is going to be a bit, and it's 3 days. It's for a 3-day run, so that's going to be wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah, just great topic.
Yeah, indeed.
It's important.
Yep. So let's take a quick break right here, and we'll be back with more Community Connection, James, right after this.
McDonald's is not new to chicken. So maybe stop questioning their chicken cred and get your hands on the McCrispy. Juicy fried chicken, buttery bun, unmatched pickle to chicken ratio. Yeah, they know what they're doing. In fact, we can honestly say they're not new to chicken. They're true to chicken. The McCrispy. Only at McDonald's. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
W- WTOC AM, W224DI, W236CR, Indianapolis. It's time to discuss the important topics happening in and around Indy. It's Community Connection with Tina Cosby. Brought to you by Child Advocates. Your voice, their future. On AM 1310, 92.7, 95.1 FM, The Light.
And we're back with Community Connection. And James, what a riveting conversation. That was a good one. And one that we don't have often enough.
Yeah, that's why it's important to see this play and for them to do this play, is because we need to have these conversations. Too many children are being taught through one venue or another, mm-hmm. you know, because I've seen them in schools, in the elementary and the middle schools and the high schools. Mm-hmm. Well, by the time they get to the high schools, you know, they've got some a little sense, but they teach them young, based on this color scheme of what is valuable and what isn't valuable. Mm-hmm. Remember, we go back to that Iowa teacher that did that experiment way back in the...
Oh, the dolls.
Yeah, yeah. The black dolls got the thumbs down and the white dolls.
And, you know, modern culture, arts, if you will, the theater arts, television, what have you. I mean, who can forget that movie back in the day, the very first one with Freddie Washington and Imitation of Life. Where she was, you know, so horrified of being found out that she was passing. And, I mean, passing is a completely different that's another dynamic. But, you know, we talk about passing, you know, and then the story of the tragic mulatto or the quadroons or, you know, all of those things throughout
they
history.
They found out that she was, what they told her she was black. And she resented that.
Yeah.
She was fine with the passing. But when she had to face the fact that she was African-American, she didn't want to live in that world, which told you that there's two different experiences, or there was at that time and still is.
Indeed. Right. And she was just so, you know, her mother, you know, who can forget that scene at the end?
She totally resented.
And that was horrible. That was so tragic because, you know, the people that passed, it was a no-win situation because they lived in, you know, all their lives in horror of being found out. And then on the other end of that, they never knew. You know, their families will never know their history or their rich history or whatever, because they disappear. They just disappear into a culture.
So much to this dynamic, you know, because you said your dad, the side of the family, light-skinned. I've had light-skinned people in my life from childhood who wanted to be more black than the black people. You know, the dark-skinned people who get ostracized and teased like they're going to see in this Asante play at the Warren Performing Arts Center on Friday, Saturday, Sunday. And then at the other end, there's light-skinned people who feel like, hey, I'm just as black as you are, but I'm treated differently.
Right.
Like my aunt.
She was traumatized by that. And like I said, would not. And when she did, you know, she simply would not have anything to do with anybody, you know, light-skinned in terms of who she dated. And that was her way of processing. Yeah, that's the way of processing it, and that's how she fixed it. Right. And in her mind, her children would never be treated like she was. There's both ends of it, Jane. But my grandmother used to point out these families. She would sit there, you know, see that family over there, they color struck. Don't fool with them, you know. Oh my goodness, you don't even want me to get started on my grandmother. But she was,
that's the basis for a lot of our problems. They're worth much.
I'm not too much of anything. Yeah. I don't know, but I really welcome and applaud this run at it, because it sounds like an absolutely wonderfully uplifting piece of theater, very thought provoked. Yeah. And Deborah Asante, I mean, she's dedicated her life to making sure that, you know, that young children understand the value of learning and appreciating their culture and their people. And she's done that so marvelously and so wonderfully over the years. So we applaud her for that. William, go ahead. How are you?
How you doing, Miss Dana James?
Doing well. William, can you get to somewhere where we can hear? We can't hear you very well.
Yeah, I can't hear you.
Yeah.
Bring your voice up a little bit.
I'm in my car.
Are you on hands-free?
Yes.
Okay. I can hear you better now.
Yeah.
Okay. The light-complected black people always thought that they were superior in the area that I came from.
Okay. I like the way you put that, in the area where you came from. Okay.
Right. We had some people that were so fair-skinned, and the hair was so straight that a lot of the white people thought that the people that we were dealing with were white.
Right.
And we ran into a lot of problems when we was in the stores playing with the sisters. I'm gonna call the name. Playing with the sisters, they thought that we was playing with the white kids, and that was supposed to be a no-no back in the day. And one of the things that I found here that we started to buy into the complexion, right? If you're mellow, if you're yellow, you're mellow. If you're black, get back. And we started buying into that.
Yeah, it was forced upon us, but we started accepting it and buying into it.
That's exactly what happened.
Yeah.
And as we grew older, you know, the concept is going to take on a cemented set in our minds, and it was something that we couldn't get away get around, seeing that the light complexion people were higher and higher positions than we were, you know. The only answer to that was to get away from the situation.
What do you mean?
I'll move to another area.
Oh, okay.
As you was in the area that I came from, you moved to New York and Chicago, you know. And you found that area was a little bit more acceptable. And being that way, you had a greater chance of moving to a higher position than you would have if you stayed in the area that you were in. And, you know, and that's what we did.
It
worked out for us.
Yeah. Some of it is so sad, though. It's just wrong. Yeah.
But the problem is, the problem still exists. That's the problem.
What do you mean?
The problem still exists. We still have a remnant of the people that thinking that the light skinned people is more inferior, more superior than the black skinned people. And they will tell you that. So, you know, we have to adjust in a manner that will cause the concept to be defended in the mind of the people. I mean, totally demanding in the mind of the peoples.
Understand
what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Yeah. We have to, in other words, we have to start to deal with the subject that all men are created equal. And we have to go to the Bible, what God said, he is no respecter of persons.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And we got to deal with this thing on intelligence don't have anything to do. With a skin color.
Yeah. Well, yeah. We definitely know that.
Yeah. That's the concept that we got to deal with and come together and deal with the subject of, since we are of the same mankind, it doesn't make no difference what one person has tried to impose upon us in order to make us feel inferior.
Yeah, remnants of a ridiculously brutal institution called slavery.
Institutionalized.
Yep. Institutionalized indeed. All righty. Thank you, William. Excuse me. Good points. James, I don't know if you saw this or not, just some local stuff, but it looks like I was telling my daughter about how I read yesterday where an inmate at the Justice Center killed his cellmate strangled him with a. Did you read about that? And just as I was,
I know how he killed him. I read
with a But you know what? I don't understand. He did it with the sheet, and then the report just kept saying this. You know, according to the video, according to the video. My question, as I was reading the report, was, well, if the video shows all this, how who was watching or who was not watching the video? And at the same time, comes word that the family of another person who was in police custody, the family has filed a wrongful death lawsuit. That man that was in the mental health crisis says here, the AP, the family of a man who died in police custody during a mental health crisis earlier this year has filed a wrongful death lawsuit against the city of Indianapolis and six IMPD officers. On April 25th, police were called to a home in the 3700 block of Marison Place. I think that's out east. Where 39-year-old Herman Whitfield III was having a mental health episode. His mother called 911 and asked for an ambulance to help her and husband get mental health care for their son. Instead, the lawsuit said police deployed a taser and essentially crushed the breath from him. Six officers arrived, and his mother responded in the and you know, it goes on and on and on. So I was saying that the inmate who was killed by his cellmate with the cameras rolling, that's a lawsuit. And then at the minute I said that, this pops up, you know, this popped up as well. So, you knew that was
apparently,
coming.
You know, I was provided with this information from Mark Ruffalo, the Urban League, that this lawsuit was filed. Police officers are named as defendants: Stephen Sanchez, Adam Ahmad, Matthew Vert, Dominique Clark, Jordan Bull, and Nicholas Matthew. They're all named as defendants. Apparently, what the lawsuit is claiming is that they went to the house because after the family called for an ambulance, and I guess the Mr. Whitfield, according to the lawsuit, went in, you know, went into the kitchen, and the officers followed him in there. He was hit with a taser, according to the lawsuit, and fell on the floor, and then several officers, according to the lawsuit, got on top of him, and according to the lawsuit, he claimed, "I couldn't breathe."
Crushed. Yes, what it
said. Died later.
Well, you know, that's going to be a lawsuit. I mean, so is this other one, this death. I mean, that's going to be a huge lawsuit because he wasn't protected while in custody, even though there was a video, you know.
How many million-dollar new facility at that Justice Department?
I don't know.
Within, what, a half a year or so since opening, we already have a murder inside of the...
It's
got to be... Like you said, a lot of high-tech cameras and stuff like that.
Yeah, and the report kept referencing that the alleged or the suspect, the person allegedly committing the crime, kept looking up, trying to get away from the camera so that he couldn't be seen. So he was keenly aware that a camera was there. It's just, like you say,
that speculate, just... Was it staffing issues or what? I mean, I know they're offering, you know, several thousand dollars to sign on and to work there, but you know they've had they've acknowledged staffing issues. Was that the problem there that they didn't?
I don't know. I haven't looked that deeply. You know, haven't heard anything. Don't know, but somebody should have been watching. You cannot defend. You know, even if it's just all cameras, somebody should be watching all the cameras.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, you've seen these setups. That where you've got cameras and things going on just about everywhere, you know, you got you don't need every one person for every cell for every camera.
Right.
But anyway, old dude, go ahead. How are you?
Hey, just want to say real quickly, you guys got a nice program. I really appreciate Miss Tina. Been following you for years, Channel 8 to TLC, and Mr. James, you're very wise. What I wanted to say was... I would like, you know, if possible, for you guys to have a real nice segment on the pro-black and pro-white race relationships going through the city here. Because, see, there's sometimes when you guys have conversations like that, you got people that are supposed to be intelligent you know, and very wise on the subject, but a lot of the stuff they saying just don't make any sense at all. You know, I'd like to really, you know, bail in on some of that, you know, if you guys could possibly do it. Also,
give me an example, old dude. Give us an example because I want to drill into that. Explain a little more.
Okay, well, see, like, a few weeks ago, I called in and asked a question about how many blacks was on the, you know, how many blacks was there when they signed the United States Constitution. And unfortunately, some individual gave a comment and said Christmas Addicts, which was not there. So
I don't know who said. I don't remember that.
He was dead.
Yeah, it was a while back.
Yeah, he would have been long.
Yeah, it was a while back. The individual that made the comment, he stated that you know, Christmas Addicts was there. But here's what I want to say.
Oh, you're talking about a call? Well, okay, well, maybe a caller.
So here's what I want to say. If you guys have like a nice segment, since the country seems to be divided now, pro black, pro white, if they really look at it and not be scared to read and do research, they'll find out we're more closer together than we are far apart. Now, like you take Queen Latifah, for instance, her family would not be eligible for any reparations because her great-great-grandfolks was born free. So you see, when you start looking at it and you start really researching it, you'll find out that we're a whole lot closer together than we think. The people that consider themselves to be pro-black, if they really dig back and look and do some real tight research, they'll find out although they're pro-black, they've got white in their family.
Yeah.
And a lot of the so-called neo-Nazis that's pro-white, they look at it and really look at it real deep, they'll find out they got black in their family. The last thing I want to say and get out of the way is, okay, we've got the Proud Boys, the Oath Keeper, and all those folks showing up. Whatever happened to this, forgive me for saying this, but whatever happened to the so-called black activist movement, you know, like the Black Panthers, the New African Black Panthers. What happened to them guys? You don't hear anything about any of that movement, but all of a sudden we got an explosion of neo-Nazis. And I'll just, you know, sit back and listen to you guys talk because you guys are very knowledgeable on a lot of things. Actually, you guys educated a 300-year-old man like me.
Actually, we've had on this show on more than one occasion people affiliated with the new Black Panther Party. Have we not, James?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And
what a lot of people may not know is that the old Black Panther Party is still, I guess, somewhat in existence, but does not in any way, shape, or form acknowledge the new Black Panther Party. So therein lies a rift and a difference in philosophy. There is a difference in, I'll just leave it as a difference in philosophy. And James, if you want to add to that, you can.
Well, I think old dude's point too is correct in that. Why is it that we're not seeing more resistance and more counter arguments and counter, I think, positions to the growth after Donald Trump, during and after Donald Trump?
Oh, just nationally, you're talking about a national push.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. To this rise in the white supremacist groups, which seem to have flourished. Now, I think they're seen as bigger than what they are, but I do think that even people who would not go as far as being a member, they sympathize with some of their views about different subjects that are related to black folks in particular. That's just my view, but I think he brings a good point, and you do too, about how I'm not
I can't. I'm not qualified to speak on the new Black Panther Party. I know the old Black Panther Party. They started out, like in Chicago, mm-hmm. feeding children. I mean, that's what they, you know, they were trying to mm-hmm. fill a niche, a need where, you know, people didn't have food and stuff, and they thought that the police were their enemies, so they armed themselves.
Yeah, and I'm not qualified to speak on either one of them either, but I do know that there is not a coming together of the old and the new. Because of philosophical differences in terms of the outreach. Now, here's the other thing. Is the answer, I mean, because we've had, you know, the Black Lives Matter movement just absolutely exploded and took off as a result of George Floyd. So I would say that that would be the anti, in a large way, in a very sophisticated, much more sophisticated way, too, in a lot of ways. That's the anti.
Yeah, it is, and they've taken a different approach.
Right.
Yeah, and that movement is, I think, more encompassing,
far more far-reaching. Yeah.
Yeah, it's less narrow than the earlier movements because this movement includes all kinds of people, all colors, who are determined. To change the situation.
Yeah. And you know, I think he's talking about, you know, white extremism and Black military, you know, just militant, you know, militant Blacks and white extremists. Yeah. Why is there not that juxtapositioning? And I don't know. I don't know. Rachel, go ahead. Go ahead.
So, I wanted to comment. I heard him talking about, like, that these white supremacist groups are getting stronger. No, they're not. They've always been there. Mm-hmm. They've always been there. This is no strength. We're just now seeing it because media is putting this stuff out so much because we're feeding off of it and they're putting it out there. But this is always, I mean, especially me living in Indiana, I'm biracial. They've always been there and they've always been strong. We're just now paying attention. And it kind of reminds me of, like, the homeless situation in Indiana during COVID. You know, everybody turned a blind eye, but then when something happened, oh, here it is. This is the issue. You know, this is going on. Mm-hmm. Well, we've always been there. And hold on. I want to say one more thing. That Black Lives Matter, let me tell you, that's white people make a joke out of that, okay? Mm. Because I was watching a disgusting I'm not going to judge. I was watching a show. It's called Queer as Folk. It's on Peacock. And the opening scene is a male having sex with another male, and the white man is bent over, and he's got a Black Lives Matter tattoo, a tramp stamp of it. So they're making a joke. White people are making a joke out of that movement.
Yeah.
That's what
Let me
I
ask
think.
You this. Why is it the replacement theory that the white supremacists, which you say is there, it's I don't know how broad it is, but what are they so afraid of? The explosion in people of color, the fastest growing population, according to, was it Professor Johnson? Is that
The 2020 census.
Doesn't it go back to they're afraid of what they don't know? Right?
Yeah.
And these things, if you look at it sociologically, like these things are instilled in them, right?
But you know what? I do want to push back a little bit in turn. Yeah, certainly the media is giving these white supremacist groups a lot more attention than what they deserve. But it is a known fact that they are growing because they have been getting a lot more support, a lot more, you know, propping up, if you will, from the likes of those that tend to follow 45 and some of the others. So they're rejuvenated and. The FBI's admonition to someone, what was, how many years ago was that? That was during Barack Obama's administration, James, that these white supremacist groups were the fastest growing and the most dangerous, you know, the homegrown domestic terrorism is going to be the largest threat, the largest domestic threat in the coming years. Because they are growing. They are gathering steam. And so I what was it? Do you remember the FBI report, James?
No, but just to that point, the Texas legislature organized over the weekend, and what they did was one of the prongs in their platform was to secede the Texas. You know, this is Juneteenth weekend. Mm-hmm. Texas should secede from the Union. That's Civil War stuff.
Yeah.
What were you going to say, Rachel?
I was going to say, you know, I do see your point then on the growth, because what about this QAnon? I think about that.
Yeah.
And
they're just gathering steam.
They're domestic terrorists at this point, because they are.
Well, I mean, here's the thing.
That's what all this stuff boils down to.
Domestic terrorism is one of the biggest domestic threats. The domestic terrorism has been deemed a larger threat than foreign terrorism in the U.S. And the U.S. has been given the wake-up call, and no one has heeded the call, James, and hasn't really listened until these recent explosions or what have you.
That's true.
But I remember. Yeah, I remember. Yeah, it's coming.
You could turn a blind eye before.
Well, the fact of the matter is that these groups were growing, and so turned a blind eye not to their existence, but turned a blind eye to the fact that they had been gathering. Yeah, to their growth, and there has been growth, and there have been warnings.
I see where you're coming from.
Yeah, there have been warnings from the FBI. So that's it. But
thank you for letting me know that, though.
Pardon?
Thank you for informing me about that.
I got to look at it. Yeah, the terrorism reports and things of that nature. Nobody wants to believe in domestic terrorism. Nobody wants to believe that these groups that they call loosely formed gangs. Nobody wants to believe that they are as they are, but they are. And something needs to be done. James, go ahead. Yeah.
I was just going to say, if these thoughts just keep coming to me, and you know, maybe I think I'm kind of loony, Tina, but you know, we have these people being killed at night when they are by themselves, usually on, you know, roads that are not too busy, not too occupied, and they can't figure out who did it. I mean, it's not one where, you know, somebody got shot in the house like they did the other. I mean, we have to be wary of these things. Could it be these groups that are looking for, you know, in sort of a modern day lynching, people to shoot? That's why I said, you know, that I've said numerous times, be careful when you're out there, especially alone.
Indeed. Yeah. All right. Thank you, Rachel. Appreciate it.
Thank you for letting me speak.
Yeah, thank you. And Denise will take your call. Will be the last one of the segment, and then we are moving on to our next guest. Go ahead, Denise. How are you?
Pretty good. How are you?
Good, thank you.
And James, I wanted to tell you, Tina, you're absolutely correct. I don't remember who wrote that report, but it was during President Barack Obama's time.
Mm-hmm.
And the domestic threat was white males.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They were associated with the domestic terrorists.
Yeah, I couldn't remember. I can't remember all of it, but I do remember it was during Obama's administration. Yeah, I can't
remember. And now, as I look back when you said that, who are the terrorists? They're the white males. I don't know what happened with this young man that's in Uvaldo. I don't know what happened with him. But these white males have a lot of anger towards people of color.
Yeah.
You
got to look at internet radicalization and all kinds of other things. You got to factor all those in as well. And Facebook and some of the others. Yeah, go ahead.
This is what I don't understand, though. How does a Hispanic be the leader of the Proud Boys? You do know he's non-white.
Yeah, I know he's non-white. Yeah. You can look at him and tell that.
He's kind of the Hispanics for Trump in Florida. I know what you're talking about.
In Dade County in Miami, James, they've taken over the GOP. They absolutely own it. They own the GOP.
They own it.
Yeah.
Like as if it's a full prize or as if it's an organization that is plus for human beings, period.
Yeah.
I mean, I just don't get it.
Right,
well, my last comment is on this, what do you call it? It's not called a trial, but what is this that they've shown President
The January 6th hearings, the committee hearings. Yeah, there's another one tomorrow. There's another one tomorrow.
Yep. Oh, it is absolutely fascinating.
I'm telling you.
Yeah.
The only thing that I learned new was how they treated that African-American family. That's the only thing that I
wasn't
heard
that, horrible?
That was new.
Yeah. It wasn't that horrible.
Oh, it feels awful.
Yeah.
It feels absolutely awful. I just don't know where the Muslim men in that state, in that city? Where were them? Because they're so protective of the African-American women.
They have to know, and there's a lot of things that go with that. I want to know where, it doesn't have to necessarily be Muslim men. Where was the United States of America? This woman, these women are citizens, and they have citizens' rights. They deserve every protection that anybody else should have. So first and foremost, they should have been protected by their own people, their own government.
Yes.
Right, too.
Yes.
Not
then,
people.
You know, I'm wondering, can they sue, especially Giuliani and Trump, for the false characterization? Accusation?
You know what, Denise, and thank you very much for your call, because I have to, I'm going to chuckle a little bit, because I'm telling you, when I was hearing their testimony yesterday, I was thinking in my head, cha-ching, cha-ching, every ambulance chasing lawyer in the United States of America was trying to get in touch with these women, because they felt money, let it rain.
The lady, you know, the mom said that the FBI to leave.
Yes, honey.
That's a lawsuit.
You can't tell me that lawyers are not
danger her family within 48 hours. Yeah.
Yeah, but you can't tell me attorneys are not knocking down those women's doors, because they are.
You know what? Because if I was an attorney, I'd drive the highway. I don't fly, but I'd drive the highway and I'd get there.
Yes, indeed.
I'd give them my card and tell them I'll get you a bonus. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Well, you know, what's his name? Ben Crump. He can do it. Ben Crump.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
He gets all kinds of settlements. Cha-ching, Ben Cha-ching Crump. Yes. He don't lose. He don't lose. He's a civil litigator. Yeah, he's a civil litigator.
They're going to need a lot of prayer for a while.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah. And all right. Thank you, Denise. Appreciate you.
Thank you.
And you know what? We're going to, Ben Crump is a civil litigator. And so look at the settlements that he has litigated for so many.
The most prominent civil rights attorney of this age.
I'm telling you. He's a superstar.
Not Thurgood Marshall or Benjamin Hooks, but he's, the prominent one now.
Yeah, he's the it boy. I'll tell you, the it man, I should say. Not the it boy, but the it man. The it child, the it one. James, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back and talk about honor flights and military veterans and a whole bunch of other things that that I think we need to talk about more as well. So we'll be right back with more Community Connection right after this.
Let's get back to the conversation. It's Community Connection with Tina Cosby from Isaacs and Isaacs Injury Lawyers, WeWin.com Studios on AM 1310, 92.7, 95.1 FM, The Light.
And we are back with Community Connection. I'm Tina Cosby here with our contributing analyst, James Patterson. James, our next guest is a U.S. Army veteran and an advocate for the rights of all military veterans, including nearly two decades old practice called honor flights. We've talked about this a little bit. Honor Flights, James, as you know, is a network of independent volunteers that they pool their resources to pay for air travel to the nation's capital, Washington, D.C., so that veterans can see and experience the memorials that have been erected in their honor. And I tell you what, D.C. is the memorial and monuments capital. I mean, there's so many there, and rightfully so. So joining us now is Chaz Simpson, CEO of Seven Principles. Mr. Sampson, I cannot read. I will take that. Let me try that again. Chaz Simpson, CEO of Seven Principles. Mr. Simpson, welcome. How are you today?
I'm well, yourself. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for being here. So tell us a little bit about, your background and about Seven Principles. I was curious. That sounds really, really interesting.
I'm a U.S. Army veteran. Served 5 years in the Army, deployed to Iraq. I was a decision maker for the Department of Veteran Affairs as a Raider. And then after that, I transitioned to the Pentagon. And I started Seven Principles about 8 years ago. And our goal is to ensure veterans get the most out of their VA disability compensation claims.
So why do you do what you do?
Well, this is my passion. I love doing it. I'm a veteran myself, and I struggle with the process. And as a decision maker, I've seen some of the decisions that I was making as a Raider that just were not, quote-unquote, fair for veterans, mostly in part because policy and federal guidelines, guide my decision. And I wanted to be more of a resource to my fellow brothers and sisters. And so a lot of mayors and law firms started asking for my help on how to manage cases and provide results to veterans, and that just grew into a business opportunity. I never really wanted to be a CEO or to run a firm or anything like that, but the nature of the results we got for our clients and how well we were doing with people across the world ended up becoming a pretty large business as it is today.
Yeah, indeed. James?
Yeah, thank you for being with us, Mr. Sampson. I really appreciate it. Listen, I just looking at what you do, which as Tina alluded to a lot,
yeah.
One of the things that you, one of the seven Army values alludes to those seven principles that Tina talked about, and it says here that it empowers veterans transitioning out of the military by assisting with a VA claims process, appeals cases, and the last two, those are good ones right there, because a lot of people, mm-hmm. they don't know that they have these benefits that they are entitled to, but entrepreneurship and more. Tell me about the entrepreneurship and more. Tell us, and how extensive is the entrepreneurship assistance, and what's the more mean? Those two questions.
Yeah, so the more, of course, entrepreneurship is a very broad term, and, quite frankly, it can be misconstrued in regards to what entrepreneurship really is. And, obviously every entrepreneur defines what that is, but what we provide is a service, a very, very unique and a very boutique service to particular veterans that are looking to grow, start, and scale their businesses. I also created a workbook that's on Amazon that folks can go find, where it teaches you the processes of running a business. And to make it very simple, we teach other veterans on how to use the resources that the federal government provides. We have a number of what's called set-aside contracts. We also have a number of different resources that we can use just as being a veteran if you're honorably discharge, and also if you have a percentage of 10% or more. And so what we provide is for those that are looking to get into government contracting, we do their cases on an expedited manner because a lot of them are looking to get service connection so they can be able to get those set-aside contracts such as SDVOSB and VOSB. And then, of course, for those that are looking to actually start a business, they get in contact with us, they come through our system and our cycle. We then have that conversation about what entrepreneurship looks like for them, and scale out a plan to actually grow their business, whether it's automation or whether it's business creation. And seven principles from a legal standpoint, seven principles, our main focus is to do VA disability claims. But we have other companies that are subsidiaries. So CoreZac is actually another company that I started about 3 years ago that manages all the business processes from formation of LLCs, S-Corp, C-Corp, LLPs, and so forth, to actually design automation, creating CRMs, and integrating different front-facing applications to make a process quick and easy, and just overall organizing the business. And we primarily focus on military and veterans in the service-based industries.
So tell us a little bit about the Honor Flight Network and your interest in making sure that it stays active. Excuse me.
Yeah, well, that's not a big bullet for us as far as what the company's mission is. It is a very big thing that we talk about amongst ourselves as practitioners. We really look up to those that are providing these honor flights for veterans. And for the listeners out there, the honor flights are for World War II veterans, and it offers a flight to the nation's capital here in Washington. And they can, of course, view the memorials and so forth. Recently, one of our PR analysts sent us a video about the founder of one of the processes where they actually have a VR component for those veterans that cannot move. Now, World War II veterans are not our biggest demographic of clients, mostly in part due to age. A lot of those veterans have either taken care of their benefits to some means, or they have, of course, passed on. The majority of our clients are Iraq War veterans. But the World War II veterans, we hold them dear in our heart, mostly in part because they paved the way for veterans like myself to be able to serve overseas in combat zones.
So I thought it served from World War II to the Korean War through the war to Vietnam and catastrophically.
Yeah, it serves all. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think World War II is the biggest.
Is the basis?
Number of those folks. Yeah, it's the base of it. Yeah, from my understanding.
Yeah, yeah. And so, what is it that you're looking to do more of? I guess I should say, what are you looking to do more of, sir?
I don't understand your question.
In terms of your outreach and the work that you're doing, what are you looking to do more? Where do you feel the need is the most for veterans? Where is the most? What are you looking to do more of for veterans? Is it housing? Is it employment? Is it medical? Where do you think the greatest need lies? I should have been more clear. I'm sorry.
Well, I mean, for what our mission requires, we always lean towards the greatest need is, of course, maximize your VA disability claim.
Uh-huh.
If you're essentially less than 100%, you probably have some extra money out there that you're due. Mm-hmm. Unknowingly, a lot of veterans end up never ever getting their money, mostly in part because they had no knowledge that there was actually out there for them to receive. Mm-hmm. But if you had to ask, you know, globally, you know, outside of what our mission is and what the need is for veterans, I would say the number one thing would be, you know, a better transition and process, which there have been a lot of, you know, great programs that have been created, a lot of opportunities that have been, you know, offered to military transition members. But we talk to probably 300 veterans per day, military members too. That number is military that's transitioning, military that's about or thinking about transitioning, and also veterans themselves. Out of the 300 folks we talk to every single day, the biggest thing we do come across is some of the men and women that are transitioning mm-hmm. are not very aware of what's going to be happening when they get out. And the ones that are very aware, they are some of our prime clients because they have their affairs together. And the ones that don't, we help them get their affairs together. So I would say to answer your question, from our mission, it's obviously the VA disability claims process.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very clear mission for us. And then globally, outside of what we actually do every single day in, day out, would be the transitioning component of how the military can actually leave the military.
So if you could give one piece of advice to the veterans that are in your purview, that you serve and that you're targeting, what would that piece of advice be? And how can veterans get a hold of you for more?
Sure. I would say remain consistent and stick to evidence. That's what's going to matter, no matter whether you, you know, were a 30-year, you know, SF guy or gal, or whether you were a 4-year, you know, regular Army soldier, regular active duty component, mm-hmm. is to stick to the evidence. It doesn't matter, you know, your jumps. It doesn't matter about your combat deployment sometimes. What really matters is what you can prove. And then, of course, you know, once you have the evidence, you know, compiled, to stay consistent. Veterans can reach us at our website, 7principles.com. It's pretty straightforward. Or they can give us a call at 770-VETERAN. That's 770-VETERAN.
All right. Chaz Sampson, CEO of 7 Principles. Thank you so much for joining us today, Mr. Sampson.
My pleasure. Thanks so much.
All right. Thank you. And, James, interesting. Interesting. And, you know, he addresses a lot. He's everywhere. So, you know, good for him.
Yeah, he's everywhere. And, you know, we thought we were going to spend a lot of time on the military flights. But I think he's got some other good programs going on. Mm-hmm. And, assisting with people with VA claims processes and appeal cases. That's really a lot of time. Because I like the one thing he said that mm-hmm. many or most vets mm-hmm. end up never, you know, accessing the benefits that they're entitled to, and that's not good.
Yeah, indeed. So James, tomorrow is the next hearing, and I tell you what, if people have not been watching this and cannot see the larger picture, you still have a chance. Because this is going, these hearings are eye-opening, James.
Yeah, they're riveting. And the thing is that a lot of the witnesses have been from the former administration's own party, Republican witnesses. So although one station in particular, we all know which one that is trying to downplay this, people are tuning in. I think you said there was 30 million viewers in that first prime time. People are tuning in to see the evidence, and that's what they're just trying to show is the evidence. And we'll see where it leads. A lot of people feel like this is enough evidence. If it were somebody else, there would be prosecutions, criminal prosecutions. So we'll see what happens.
Yeah, we most certainly will see what happens. And excuse me. If you can't watch it or you can't see it, just watch the recaps. You know, watch the recaps of it. You know, that'll help as well.
What about people in your orbit? Have you? What kind of feedback are you getting?
A lot of them are. You know, yesterday was the feedback of the people in my orbit. They are riveted. They're riveting, and they're watching. And yesterday was probably the strongest day of all. I mean, yesterday elicited the most reaction from folks that I know that are watching it. How about you?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, when you have like that Arizona official, the Republican leader of the Arizona House, Bowers, who said that, I told him, no, speaking of Donald Trump, I am not going to put together a slate of electors and, substitute them for the duly elected electors. No, I'm not going to do that. Mm-hmm. So right there, he must have thought it was wrong. Or else he wouldn't have said he would not do it. And in fact, he did state he felt it was wrong.
Mm-hmm. And I did have a relative call me from the West Coast.
Mm-hmm.
And they asked me the question, do you think that we need to give credit to those, even though they were on the Trump train for as long as they were, those who finally did the right thing and came clean? What do you know? What are your thoughts on that? Do you think we need to give them credit? And I thought about that.
We did. We said that about Pence. He did the right thing at the end. But now he's out there talking about Biden, and he should be saying exactly what was done. What he knows too. What they were trying to do. We should give him tell the story right. They did finally, but it went on far too long. And to have an organized coup attempt like that, where you are putting electors on slates in states, you are calling not only state legislators, but you are calling election officials. You're calling in some cases governors. You are trying to overturn the election. So this was an organized plot, Tina. So, I think people, all of their roles should be brought out to the public like they're doing. And until we find out who did what, like they said in Watergate, what did they know? When did they know it? I hesitate to give anybody credit.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, I'm glad that they did what they did, that they're doing what they're doing now. But to uplift them and hail them as a hero or whatever, no, some of them are forced.
Yeah.
Some of it was forced and some of it, just simply. But anyway, that was a question that was asked. So,
yeah.
Very quickly, let's get this last phone call in because we gotta get out of here early because we got a lot of commercials to go. Kevin, go ahead.
Two things. One, the gentleman's phone number. I didn't get a chance to get the gentleman's phone number. He went too fast for me.
Uh-huh.
Another thing, I like what somebody said the other day. No, we don't give him credit. And he said, if you train a dog to fight and bite, and then when that dog turns around and bites you and fights you, you got to take credit for it. You taught that dog to do that. Mm-hmm. They let that man get away with so much, more than enough. They let that man get away with.
Mm-hmm.
So now they want to be, this, and that. You created this monster. You created Frankenstein. Now Frankenstein to come back and try to bite your head off, that's on you.
Mm-hmm.
You don't get credit for that.
No. Nope. I would agree with you, Kevin. No credit for that.
Yeah, Tina, do you have
Principles? Sevenprinciples.com, I believe, is it. Let me double check and make sure.
I think you're right. Kevin, if you go to sevenprinciples.com.
Yeah.
Okay.
You'll get his information. Let's see. His name is Chaz.
Chaz Sampson.
Sampson. Sampson.
Yeah, Chaz Sampson is his name.
Okay.
So, all right.
Thank you,
Kevin. Yeah. Appreciate it.
Yeah.
So, James, with that, I do believe it is time for us to go.
Good job, Tina.
Yeah, thanks. Good job, James. That's all the time we have for right now. We're always right here on WTLC AM 1310, 92.7 FM, and 95.1 FM, The Light. Our website is praiseindy.com. You can follow us on Facebook. We are The Light on Twitter. We are at Community Indy. Willie Moore Jr., your nephew, flat out your nephew, James, is up next. Thanks, everyone, for joining us. We're back tomorrow. James, you're back on Friday. Until then, everyone, please be safe and be well. For James Patterson, I'm Tina Cosby, and this is Community Connection.